Good morning. This is Sander Hicks reporting live, recording this live from Tehran, Iran. I'm here with Pepe Escobar, international journalist, muckraker extraordinaire, Hafsa Kara Mustafa of Algeria, journalist extraordinaire, and Tony Hill.
My name Hall. Is Anthony James Hall.
Anthony James Hall. Thank you. Anthony Hall from the University of Lethbridge. Thank you for being with us. We're here, as you can see, in this grand piece of architecture. This is the International Center in Tehran. We have there what you see. Let me flip this camera around so we can see it better. What you see there is the supreme leader, spiritual leader of the country, Khamenei. It looks like Khamenei, but it's actually pronounced Khamenei, I found.
Khamenei,
right. So I just wanted to talk to you guys as independent journalists here. You're kind of part, we're sort of part of the same crew, the English speakers. Let's start with you, Pepe. What's your impressions on the conference thus far?
Well, the opening is very impressive because you see the center of power in the Islamic Republic of Iran right in front of you. As the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, President Rouhani, and the Speaker of the Majlis, Ali Larijani. He will continue to be one of the top three men in Iran, whatever happens after the next elections. Mm-hmm. And whatever happens with this, it is still a taboo item in Iran, the discussion of the succession of the Supreme Leader, which is something that is going to happen sooner or later. Mm. So in practical terms, I would say conferences to support Palestine, of course, a noble endeavor anywhere, but does it alter the facts on the ground? Not at all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. Mm-hmm. You can have delegations from 50, 60 nations. A lot of Islamic nations are represented here. Mm-hmm. Russia is here. North Korea is here. South American countries are here as well. But when we compare to what could happen after Trump's famous declaration of it doesn't matter, he was remixing Deng Xiaoping, it doesn't matter if there is a one state or two states, as long as it catches mice. So he wants to do a business deal in the Middle East, especially in the Arab-Palestine-Israeli conflict, but he still doesn't know what it is because he has no clue about the intricacies on the ground, in fact.
Right.
And now we have a shadow Secretary of State, Jared Kushner, who is more or less entitled or self-entitled or appointed to be the middleman over the quartet, by the way, which was absolutely innocuous for so many years, chaired by Tony Blair, by the way, to find a solution for Israel-Palestine. Mm-hmm. All this is absurd because, and I've been talking to people from different countries here, and nobody knows what's going to happen next with everything. With American foreign policy in general, with Trump's decision, what he's going to tweet is going to be his next foreign policy decision, relations with Russia, relations with China, harassment of Iran, and of course, what's going to happen in the Middle East. So, once again, very important to have like a mini UN here in Tehran discussing Palestine, and obviously networking on the side on what's going to happen in terms of American foreign policy involving the whole planet, for that matter. But when we go back to the facts on the ground once again, we should talk to our Palestinian friends, and they give us the real outlook of what's going on and what could go even worse or totally down the drain in Palestine itself.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Pepe. One interesting point that was made yesterday in the speech from the Supreme Leader was he said that there should be no distraction, right? You were helping elucidate this point, that the Palestinian issue should not be preempted by the civil war in Syria or a number of other things. Let's go now to Hafsa, live in Tehran. Hafsa Kara Mustafa, tell me what you took away from the speech yesterday from Supreme Leader Khamenei.
Actually, I thought it was a very good speech, essentially because it was reminding everyone that the Palestinian cause should not be used for any political agenda, but for basically supporting the rights of the Palestinian people. I think it was a hint in particular towards many Arab countries who've constantly juggled with the Palestinian cause to serve their personal interests. And of course, the Palestinian issue has always been sacrificed as turmoil continues in the region. So, for instance, it has suffered from the removal of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt in favor of Sisi. It's also been very much suffering as a result of the Syria conflict, because of course Palestinians have conflicted views on that particular point as well. And so what the speech of the Iranian Supreme Leader has reminded everyone in this room is to say that actually this is about supporting an oppressed people, and that is our foremost objective. Any other consideration should not come into account. And I think that was a very important reminder. I think the fact that it's held in Iran is also an important point, because it's, again, it's a bit of a dig at all the other. I mean, this is a Persian Shia country, and the Palestinian people are Arab and Sunnis. You would have expected a conference of this scale to have been held in an Arab, a fellow Arab Sunni country, and that hasn't been the case. So I think it's also a sign of the solidarity of the Iranian people, and of course a message to indicate that they're not a sectarian people, and their political outlook is not sectarian, as has often been the case, the accusations that have been leveled at them. So again, for those reasons, I think it's an important conference. I think some of the speakers that came after were slightly disappointing. They made their very lackluster declarations. Some of them were reiterating points that were in contradiction with the Iranian position, which is that actually Israel is an illegitimate entity, whereas others were insisting on the two-state solution. So I think there is still ground to actually discuss what is the outlook for most people when it comes to the issue of Palestine.
Netanyahu himself was in the U.S. Congress saying, you know, this country should be invaded. Sheldon Adelson publicly says it should be nuked. So it's it really is the country most targeted, most enthusiastically, sort of in a high-profile way, targeted for destruction in its present form, for regime change, or however it might be framed. And so this country at this moment is stepping forward and saying, we are going to lead the Islamic Republic of Iran, the defense of the Palestinian people, this assault on, you know, our fellow human beings, Palestinian people, that is has been going on essentially since the Balfour Declaration, since 1917, and it simply gets more and more emboldened, more and more concerted,
yeah.
So that we've got to the point where essentially with the coming to power of Trump and his backing from those who are on the right-wing extremes of Israeli, the political landscape, the inheritors of revisionist Zionism, of Eretz Israel, of Israel as an expansionary project,
yeah,
sort of extending from the United States, which itself was an expansionary project, you know, of westward expansion.
Right, manifest destiny and all that stuff, right.
Yeah. And
which is funny. And we were just talking earlier about how, like, there's a way to interpret Judaism. You were saying that, like, that there's a whole branch of Judaism I'm just learning about now at this conference that says that the Jews should not have any military role, or the Jews should not serve in the military. And you pointed out, Hasfa, that the Orthodox Jews have been able to be exempt from,
yes,
military service in Israel, and yeah, that certain Jews say that they should not, there should be no nation state for the Jews. They should always...
For much of the history of the 20th century, you know, a big part of Jewish public opinion was that Zionism is not the correct course.
Right.
And
it's a form of heresy. It actually goes against the basic principles of Judaism, because, and that's one of the reasons why Orthodox Jews do not participate in the military, because they shouldn't fight under a banner, under a flag, under a nation flag. This is why some of the Jews are here present, Orthodox Jews are present in this conference.
And of course, many of the Jewish critics of Zionism in the 20th century observed, you know, we're integrated into the countries where we live, we share in the national values and are, you know, comfortable, and if it's posed that there is a nation state, a sovereign country that represents Jews collectively,
then this puts us in an awkward position, because then the question will arise, well, where do our allegiances rest? What if this Jewish state has different priorities or different interests than the countries where we're situated? And so this is a question which really is coming to the forefront now. Donald Trump says America first, but is his policy America first, or is it a repetition of what we see in all the Western countries, which is Israel first, that the most dominant, powerful lobby is that which says, Israel is under assault, Israel must do self-defense. It's always framed in terms of, you know, Israel is the victim of Palestinian aggression and therefore needs to engage in self-defense. This is this mantra is repeated in all our countries.
Yeah.
So this Trump regime, you know, it looked for a time, and I certainly bought into it, that Hillary Clinton was the kind of chosen one of the neocons, the people who supported George W. Bush and responded to 9/11 in the way they did, that Hillary Clinton had that constituency. But lo and behold, you know, as the power is shifted, it seems that Trump is the favored candidate of Netanyahu.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there may be a connection here, which is beautifully explored in the brand new book that I just finished translating and will soon be published by Laurent Guyonneau. It's called From Yahweh to Zion. And in this book, it's really a modern and fair-minded and very, very erudite treatment of the Jewish question, what used to be called the Jewish question, which I never even, in the past, I rejected the idea that there was such a thing or a Jewish problem. I said, there is no such thing. There's a problem of Zionism, but there's no Jewish problem. But Laurent Guyonneau, with his historical erudition, has gone back and looked at a certain pattern in history that involves essentially a small elite, a cognitive elite, and of course a power elite in the Jewish community that has been myth-making in order to brainwash people, primarily their own people, that is primarily the Jewish tribe, by saying, you must obey Yahweh, which is a code word for the Jewish tribal leaders, the cognitive elite, and you must smash the idols of other tribes rather than work with them or intermarry with them, and you must essentially rob and plunder them through deceit, stealth, and treachery, and all these other evil tribes, the Goyim, the other nations, are out to get you, so you have to get them first, essentially. This has been a kind of a programming that's been drilled into Jewish people by this unscrupulous cognitive elite, to the point that Guyonneau suggests that the Jewish community in many times and places has acted towards other communities in the same way that a psychopath acts toward other individuals. And so this is a kind of a nutshell description of what Guyonneau sees as the so-called Jewish problem or Jewish question. And he argues that it's Jews themselves who ought to be welcome this research and to liberate themselves from this programming of their cognitive elite. But that said, I would add that the myth-making capacity of this Jewish cognitive elite down through the millennia is quite extraordinary. And as a folklorist, I've been trained to appreciate expressive culture, great storytelling, great myth-making, great legend-telling, you know, urban legends. I studied Sufi legends in Morocco for my PhD. I love creative, all forms of creative expression. And so I think we should appreciate that. We can appreciate the amazing story of Exodus, the incredible storytelling quality of the Old Testament, and even the kind of amazing, if often cheesy and creepy, storytelling in today's very corrupt Hollywood, which of course is dominated by our current Jewish cognitive elite. We can appreciate the expressive culture aspect of all of this, but we should also use our critical intellects to take it apart, understand what's really going on, how it's really working, and then mitigate the most harmful things that are coming out of this, such as all of these false stories about the clash of civilizations, the war on terror, all of these false flag attacks that are being arranged, the assassinations of our greatest leaders like the Kennedys, who were killed, I think, largely by what we might call a Jewish mafia.
All right, let's go there. You blew my mind with your latest fact about Jack Ruby, who was actually Jack Rubenstein, the guy who covered up and killed Lee Harvey Oswald, the main patsy. What was your new insight into that? You broke it down other day.
I mentioned that Guyonneau cites convincing evidence, and I forget the source, that Rubenstein, a close associate of Mickey Cohen, the Jewish mafia leader from California, who is the source of the character in The Godfather, who puts the horse's head in the bed. Remember
yeah,
the horse's
yeah,
head?
Of course, of
That's
course.
Mickey Cohen that did that. Mickey Whoa. Cohen was a close associate of Jack Ruby and Rubenstein, who a mob hitman and liaison between the Dallas Police Department and the Jewish mafia, who was, he came into the Dallas Police Department on the day he shot Oswald as a translator for Israeli journalists.
So why, pray tell, if that's true, why would the Mossad want to kill a nice Catholic boy like Jack Kennedy?
Oh, man. Well, long story short is that David Ben-Gurion and other hardline Israeli leaders were absolutely convinced that they needed nuclear weapons to guarantee the security and expansion of their state of, you know, on the ongoing project of Greater Israel. John F. Kennedy was absolutely dedicated to shutting down the Israeli nuclear program, and Lyndon Johnson was a long-term Israeli agent in Mol, who'd been working with the Jewish mafia throughout his entire career. So that's the long and short of it, was that Kennedy was killed to make sure Israel developed its nuclear weapons.
Interesting. But we were just talking at breakfast about the North Koreans and the nuclear. You were saying you thought it was good that the North Koreans had an augmented amount of respect because you can't invade them because they have the nuclear option. And I was taking more of a John Kennedy kind of perspective of saying we need to have less nuclear weapons in the world. And I know the U.S. should lead by example, and the U.S. is trying to take apart some of its outdated ICBMs.
Well, it's trying to take away some of its dated. Doesn't mean it doesn't have any. And as long and as we mentioned earlier, all it would take is one major bomb.
All you need
anyway.
Is one, right?
So the amount is irrelevant. But the point is that whoever possesses a nuclear arm actually becomes untouchable. We've seen this. So you have slightly belligerent talk against Pakistan or India, for instance, but it never really escalates to any extent in the way that it does with Iran or any other countries. What we've seen with North Korea is, despite its quite a brazen and an arrogant attitude at times, it still is untouchable. And I think the point that they made was basically a nudge to people, this is what actually keeps you protected. Now, from a moral standpoint, we can oppose nuclear weapons, and of course we should. But again, when you look at the fact that America has a voracious appetite for war, it has been going after far weaker countries for many, many years now. And that's what it does, actually. It is behaving like a schoolyard bully. It goes after countries that are far, far weaker. And at times, even at their weakest. So they went after Vietnam after it had fought a long anti-colonial war. When it went against Iraq in 2003, it made sure that all its arsenal had been destroyed by the UN, and so that made the invasion that much easier. It went after Libya when Libya had been under regime sanction for many, many years. So it ensures that it actually targets very, very weak countries. Now, although Iran is no pushover and although Iran is no Libya or Syria, it nevertheless has been under a very stringent regime sanction. And so it isn't a powerful country, and it wouldn't stand up to an aerial assault by the US. And therefore, the only thing that could potentially protect it and protect the wider Middle East would be the idea, at the very least, that it is a nuclear power. I think that's the way to deal with the US. It really doesn't stand up to strong people. It only attacks the weaker nations. And I think in that respect, the North Korean message and the delegation from the North Koreans actually made a lot of sense.
Yeah, this particular moment in time, I'd like to sort of return to that just to put on record, you know, what we're living through. The coming to power of Trump, it's happened in a way that the so-called two-state solution is more or less defunct under the present power structure of the world.
It's been defunct for many years, though.
It's practically been defunct, and the building of the walls and the building of the settlements have effectively blocked off the possibility of actually constructing a state, an Arab or Palestinian state in the region. Nevertheless, it's part of the sort of imaginary realm that we live in. It's often comes to the fore as a possibility. It defines national policies. But this present position of the U.S. government under Donald Trump essentially puts that whole possibility formally on the sidelines. And so this expansionary trajectory embodied by the growth of settlements and then outlying settlements. And this very familiar pattern of imperialism, which is that empires grow and absorb new frontiers. And some people are on the expanding side of these frontiers, and some people are on the imploding side of these frontiers.
Mm.
The Native Americans in North America were obviously on the imploding side of frontiers. The Palestinians are on the imploding side of this frontier. So, you know, here at this very moment, when the U.S. is sort of embarked on a sort of formal transcendence of the two-state solution, the two-state solution going back to the origins of Israel, you know, in Resolution 181, that the UN plan was to partition the territory and create the basis for two countries. Hmm. And of course, in 1967, there was a war, and Israel occupied this land that was reserved, you know, for the Palestinians as a future state. So now, at this very moment, the Islamic Republic of Iran decides to put this as a major priority. It's no small thing to say, come into our national parliament, you know, many, many countries, and we will plan and we will put as our priority, and we will bring in delegates of, you know, civil society as well as countries. And here we are, you know, talking in this context, in this amazing environment.
It is quite an amazing structure, isn't it? It's got this incredible dome, steel frame structure, natural light coming through these thousands of tiny circular windows. Then you have a big lighting fixture up there over the oculus. That's called an oculus. I know this from Roman architecture. Did you know that? It's an oculus, yeah. There's one of those in the Pantheon in Rome as well. So it's a clear reference to Roman architecture here.
This country is a country, I think there might be some marginal diplomatic relations between Canada and Iran. But last time I was here, there was no formal diplomatic relationships whatsoever with Harper's government towards Iran, which was always depicted as the most menacing, terrorist-oriented state, and that rhetoric continues. Of course, Iran is becoming an integral part of an alternative alignment of Russia, China. The Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad, Hezbollah. We're in the midst of an alternative alignment of interests that does challenge the Anglo-American, Zio-American empire.
Yeah.
And so here we are at this moment in time, with this emphasis on Palestinians, the history of the assault, you know, the genocidal assault on Palestinians that continues, that becomes more and more sophisticated. In a way, the dissident populations of the world are increasingly treated as Palestinians. You know, the Israeli security companies that make their mark treating Palestinians in harsh ways. You know, they sell their wares, and this becomes sets patterns for the treatment of other people. This Islamic Republic of Iran, this revolutionary government, kind of adopts and absorbs the history of the decolonization movement. The fact that, we once had people known as freedom fighters.
Right.
And we looked at the PLO and thought, here's an organization of committed people willing to put their life on the line, people who are being assaulted to such an extent that they fight back.
You know what this convention reminds me of? This convention reminds me a lot of the Left Forum in New York City, which is... this is sort of the international version of the Left Forum. We hear a lot about the oppressed. We hear a lot about, even reading from the Quran, talking about the widow and the orphan, and protecting the most oppressed. And Khatami yesterday talked about the conditions for revolutionary change in Palestine. And so it seems to me that this is kind of like the international version of New York's Left Forum in a lot of ways. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
What is this for?
Thank you.
No worries.
What is this for?
Yeah.
It's for my radio show.
Oh, you've got a radio show. Okay.
This is going to be the debut episode. Yeah.
I think it's